The Hills' story has come to public attention with their extreme reluctance, 5 years after their event, and only because of a leak that resulted in a series of local newspaper articles. The Hills sought no publicity and were successful in holding back the story for several years before it became public under their protests. Their views on the experience are the result of a long and painful period of intelligent examination and study, both in and out of therapy. Their approach to the subject has been rational and cautious. The greatest mystery about the experience is that any assumption on the basis of the material revealed is hard to conceive or understand. An abduction by humanoid intelligent beings from another planet in a spacecraft has always belonged to science fiction. To concoct a science fiction story of this magnitude would require an inconceivable skill and collaborative capacity. It is as hard for the Hills to accept the possibility that the abduction took place as it is for any intelligent person. In fact, the attitude of the Hills is, "We did not expect or look for the sighting to take place." Barney resisted and persistently tried to deny its existence. "We did not know what happened in the missing 2 hours and 35 miles of distance until we heard voices coming out on the tape recordings. What came out on the recordings was as difficult for us to believe as for anybody else. We only know that after the pieces began coming back together, our general feelings and convictions grew on us that these experiences seem to be reality as real as our other recollections of any valid, factual memory s." The assumption that Betty's dreams were absorbed by Barney Teocret his recollection of the abduction sequence is also hard to conceive or understand. If Betty's dream had been the sole source of information about the humanoid beings, what about Barney's glimpse of persons, 293, aboard the craft, recalled in full consciousness, just before the beeping sound occurred? What about other portions of the apparent abduction that Barney recalled and Betty did not? How could the couple concoct the enormous amount of detail, strikingly similar, and stick to it so consistently? From the long and intensive exploration of the case, however, certain nearly irrefutable points emerge. 1. A sighting of some sort took place. The two major alternatives to this point are substantially refuted. 1. To concoct the elaborate stories, matched in detail, a month after the sighting, and again more than 2 years later, would have required an inconceivable precision of planning, memory, and prevision of an imponderable future. Judgments from many sources as well as psychiatrists attested to the Hills' probity and integrity. 2. No evidence was ever brought out that either of the Hills bad at any as, from 2 time experienced psychotic hallucinations. Any theory, including the dream hypothesis, which excludes these alternatives is predicated on a sighting of some object or phenomenon. 2. The object sighted appears to have been a craft. As perceived by the Hills, the craft was similar to many previously and since reported by others who have sighted unidentified flying objects. 3. The sighting caused a severe emotional reaction. Much of the direct emotional response was repressed and suppressed, a tiny unconscious expression in diffuse anxiety, dreams of nightmarish quality, and physical symptoms until releasedness only under hypnosis. 4. The anxiety and apprehension engendered by Barney Hill's racial sensitivity served to intensify the emotional response to the sighting and discharged during treatment. Some of the inner emotional experiences came to conscious. Throughout the entire trip from Montreal to the sighting, Barney Hill suffered from increasing apprehension and fear of hostile reactions to his race, though none materialized. This oppressive feeling could sensitize him to any unusual or strange experience and intensify his reactions to such an experience. S. The Hills had no ulterior motive to create such. The Hydges have kept their story restricted to a story. They had confined their experience to a small group of people for 4 years. A few intimates, and 2 interested scientists and investigators. Treatment was sought for their emotional disturbances, and THA decided to release their story only after it had been publicized without their permission 5 years after THE incident. 294, 6. The case was investigated by several technical and scientific persons who support the possibility of the reality of the experience. The investigations by Hoffman, Jackson, and Webb, based on their experience with other cases, supported the possibility that the Hills case could be a valid experience justifying scientific attention. 7. There is a measurable amount of direct physical circumstantial evidence to support the validity of the experience. No explanation has been found for the shiny bright spots on the trunk of the car which caused the compass to oscillate, nor for the failure of the Hills watches to run after the sighting experience. Barney Hill's broken binocular strap and sore neck could attest to his extreme agitation. 8. Under hypnosis by a qualified psychiatrist, both the Hills told almost identical stories of what had taken place during their period of amnesia. A dual identical psychosis, folie, A, der, is substantially excluded by their absence of other characteristics of this rare psychosis, nor was there any other evidence of psychosis. A joint fabrication is also substantially excluded. The two remaining possibilities would appear to be, 1. A totally real and true experience. 2. An experience which had been so affected by the accompanying emotional state as to produce some perceptive and illusory misinterpretations as embodied in the dream hypothesis. There are no final answers. Where one question existed before, several others have come up to take its place. But if it can even momentarily be speculated that the event is true, the far-reaching implications concerning the history of the world are obvious. Such an event would demand a re-examination of religion, politics, science and even literature. International relations would have to be thoroughly re-examined. An urgent need for a study and extensive scientific report on the subject would be quickly indicated, both national and worldwide. There is, in fact, evidence already extant that the United Nations is seriously considering a major scientific worldwide study of the subject. Neither Barney nor Betty Hill had any thought that they might be involved in such an event when they left the little restaurant at Colebrook, New Hampshire, at 10:05 p.m. on the night of September 1, 1961. They are not crusading to convert non-believers or skeptics into the acceptance of the phenomenon, although they are hopeful that some new evidence, 295, might come along to clarify without question the strange circumstances of their experience. They are content now to let whatever facts that have come out of their story speak for themselves. But as Denison has said, maybe wildest dreams are but the needful preludes of the truth. Appendix the following is the recall of Betty's dreams, which she wrote down as notes to herself after the incident had taken place. It will be noted that they are substantially the same as the recall she describes as having actually happened during the amnesic period. It is not uncommon for dreams resulting from an experience of shock to be literal, that is, a complete reenactment, so to speak, of an event that actually took place. On the other hand, such a dream neither proves nor disproves such an event. Betty Hill's detailed notes are printed here for those readers who would like to compare and detail the content of her dreams with her recall of the amnesic period as it came out under hypnosis. The similarities are marked. Dreams that occurred following the sighting of the UFO in the White Mountains on September 1, 1961, two events happened of which we are consciously aware. These are also incorporated in my dreams. First, we sighted a huge object, glowing with a bright orange light, which appeared to be sitting on the ground. In front of this, we could distinguish the silhouette of evergreen trees. Our reaction was to say, "No, not again," and then we consoled ourselves with the self-assurance it was the setting moon. At this point in the highway, we made a sharp turn to the left. Second, at the termination of this, I asked Barney if he believed in flying saucers now? He replied, "Don't be ridiculous. Of course not. I will attempt to tell my dreams in chronological order, although they were not dreamed in this way. In fact, the first dream told was the last one dreamed. My emotional feelings during 297, this part was of terror, greater than I had ever believed possible. Betty Hill recalls almost bolting out of bed during this dream. We were driving home from the sighting, when we saw the bright orange glowing shape. We saw a very sharp left-hand turn in the road and found that the road curved back to the right. At this moment, I saw 8 to 11 men standing in the middle of the road. Barney slowed down to wait for them to move, but the motor died. As he was trying to start the motor, the men surrounded the car. We sat there motionless and speechless, and I was terrified. At the same time, they opened the car doors on each side, reached in and took us by the arm. This is the first dream I had. I am struggling to wake up. I am at the bottom of a deep well, and I must get out. Everything is black. I am fighting to become conscious. Slowly and gradually I start to become conscious. I struggle to open my eyes for a moment, and then they close again. I keep fighting. I am dazed and have a faraway feeling. Then I win the battle and my eyes are open. I am amazed. I am walking through a path in the woods. Tall trees are on both sides, but next to me on both sides is a man, two men in front, two men in back, then Barney with a man on each side of him, other men in back of him. I become frightened again, and I turn to Barney and say his name, but he is sleepwalking. He does not hear me and does not appear to be conscious of what is happening. The man on my left speaks to me and asks if his name is Barney. I refuse to answer. Then he attempts to reassure me that there is nothing to fear. Barney is all right. No harm will come to us. All they want to do is make some tests. When these are completed in a very brief time, they will take us back to the car and we will go safely on our way home. We have nothing to fear. During this time I become conscious of several things. She is referring to her dream, as all through this account. First, only one man speaks, in English, with a foreign accent, but very understandably. The others say nothing. I note their physical appearance. Most of the men are my height, although I cannot remember the height of the heels on my shoes. None is as tall as Barney, so I would judge them to be 5 to 5 feet 4 inches. Their chests are larger than ours, their noses were larger, longer, than the average size, although I have seen people with noses like theirs, like Jimmy Durante's. Their complexions were of a grey tone, like a grey paint with a black base. Their lips were of a bluish tint. Hair and eyes were very dark, possibly black. 29s, the men were all dressed alike, presumably in uniform, of a light navy blue colour with a grey shade in it. They wore trousers and short jackets, that gave the appearance of zippered sports jackets, but I am not aware of zippers or buttons for clothing. Shoes were a low, slip-on style, resembling a boot. I cannot remember any jewelry or insignia. They were all wearing military seersucks, similar to Air Force, but not so broad on the top. They were very human in their appearance, not frightening. They seemed to be very relaxed, friendly in a professional way, business-like. There was no haste, no waste of time. Until reassuring me that there was no cause for fear, the leader ignored me, and we continued to walk. I would turn back to Barney, and he still was not aware of what was happening. Incidentally, he remained in this state until we were returned to the CR at the end. We reached a small clearing in the woods. In front of us was a disc, almost as wide as my house is long. It was darkened, but appeared to be metallic. No lights or windows were seen, and I had the impression that we were approaching from the back of it. We stepped up a step or two to go onto a ramp, leading to a door. At this point I became frightened again and refused to walk. The leader spoke, firmly but gently, reassuring me that I had no reason to be afraid, but the more delay I caused by my uncooperativeness, the longer I would be away from the car. I shrugged my shoulders and agreed that we might as well get it over with. I seemed to have no choice in this situation. We entered the disc. I found a corridor, curving to the contours of the ship. We started to enter the first room, leading from the corridor, but then I found that Barney was being taken further down the hall. I objected to this, and questioned why we both could not be examined in the same room. The leader showed some exasperation with this question and my objections, and explained, as though I were a small child, that the exam would take twice as long this way, as they only had equipment to test one person at a time in a room, and he thought that I wanted to be on my way as quickly as possible. So I agreed. About 4 or 5 men entered the room with us, but when another man came in, they left. This man was the examiner and also spoke English. He was very pleasant, reassuring. He asked questions, some I had difficulty understanding, as his English was not as good as the first man's. My answers puzzled him at times. He asked my age, also Barney's. He shook his head as though he doubted me. He asked me what I ate, when, 299, I told him. He asked questions, what did vegetables look like? My favor, ate one? Squash, what did it look like, how do we eat it? I told about peeling it, cooking it, mashing it, putting salt and pepper, butter on it. He was puzzled. I tried to explain the color of it and looked for some yellow coloring in the room, but could not find any. I tried to tell about meat, milk, but he did not understand the meaning of the words using. Then the examiner said that he wished to do some tests, to find out the basic differences between him and us, that I could not be harmed in any way and would not experience any pain. Also, he would explain what he was doing as he went along. Just a few simple tests. The leader returned and remained in the room the rest of the time I was there. He was an observer during the testing. First, I sat on a stool, the examiner in front of me, with a bright light shining on me. My hair was closely examined, and he removed a few strands and then cut a larger piece on the back left-hand side. I was not able to see what he used for cutting purposes. Then he looked in my mouth, down my throat, in my ears, removing some earwax or something. They examined my hands and fingernails, taking a piece of my nail. They removed my shoes and looked at my feet. They showed much interest in my skin and pulled out some type of apparatus which they held close to my arm on the top and inside. He seemed to be adjusting this, and I wonder if he was getting a magnified view or taking a picture. He took a slender long instrument, similar to a letter opener, and scraped along my arm. As he took these samples, he would hand them to the leader, who carefully placed these on a clear material like glass or plastic, cover with another piece and wrap them in a piece of cloth. Very similar to a glass slide. Next he pulled the machine over, and asked me to lie down on an examining table. This machine resembled the wires of an EEG, an electroencephalograph, which records electrical brainwaves, but no tracing machine was seen. On the end of each wire was a needle. He explained that he wanted to check my nervous system. He reassured me that there would be no pain. Very gently he touched the ends of the needles to different parts of my body. He started with my head, temples, face, neck, behind my ears, back of my neck, all my spine, under my RMS, around my hips, and paid particular attention to my legs and feet. Sometimes only one needle would be held against me, then two, then several. A few times he would touch a spot on my body, and one would jump, or my arm or leg would jerk, a slight twitch. Both men were highly interested in 300, this test, and I feel that a recorder was being used, although one did not see one. Also during this exam, my dress was removed, as it was hindering the testing. They said the next test was a pregnancy test. The examiner picked up a very long needle, about 4 to 6 inches long. I asked what he planned to do, and he said that it was a very simple test, with no pain, but would be very helpful to them. I asked what kind of pregnancy test he planned with a needle. He did not reply, but started to insert the needle in my navel with a sudden thrust. Suddenly I was filled with great pain, twisting and moaning. Both men looked very startled, and the leader bent over me and waved his hand in front of my eyes. Immediately the pain was completely gone, and I relaxed. At that moment I became very grateful and appreciative to the leader, lost all fear of him, and felt as though he was a friend. I kept repeating my thank yous to him for stopping the pain, and he said that they had not known that I would suffer pain from this test. If they had known, they would not have done this. I could feel his concern about this, and I began to trust him. They decided to end the testing. The examiner left the room, the leader gathered up all the test samples and put them together in a drawer, and I put on my dress and shoes. Upon questioning where the examiner had gone, he told me that he was needed to complete the testing on Barney, that his was taking longer than mine, but soon we would be going back to the car. I spent the time waiting, by talking with the leader and walking around the small room. There was an absence of color in the room, and it was of a metal construction like stainless steel or aluminum. Cabinets and one door were on the curved side. The remaining two walls were intersected like a triangle. There was a bright overhead light of bluish shade. Together in one corner was the equipment used in the testing. After the leader had put away all the things, we stood on the right-hand side of the door and talked. I mentioned that this had been quite an experience and I had never had anything like this happen before. He smiled and agreed and said that of course in the beginning I had been badly frightened. They regretted this fright and had wanted to do all they could to alleviate it. I admitted that I had completely recovered and was now enjoying this opportunity to talk with him, and there were so many questions I wanted to ask. He volunteered to answer all that he could. At this point, some of the men came hurriedly into the room. Their 3149 excitement was apparent, and they were talking with the leader, but I could not understand what they were saying. They were not using words or tones with which I was acquainted. The leader left the room with them, and I became frightened that something had gone wrong with Barney's testing. The leader was gone only a short period of time. He opened my mouth and was touching my teeth, trying to move them. When he stopped, very puzzled, he said they were confused. Barney's teeth were removable, mine were not. This was an amazing discovery. The examiner returned and checked my teeth. I was laughing most heartily about this, and went on to explain that Barney had dentures. The reasons for this, while I did not need these yet, but I would as I became older, that all people lose their teeth with old age. All were very amazed, and all the men were going back and forth to Barney and then me, to look at our teeth, and to see the difference. They were unbelieving, shaking their heads. After they left, the leader asked what was old age. I said that a lifespan was believed to be 100 years, but people died at age 65 to 70 from degeneration and disease usually, some died in accidents and illnesses at all ages. I attempted to explain aging, the skin wrinkles, the graying hair, etc. He asked what was 100 years, and I could not tell him, only a way to measure time. Then I broached the subject again of this whole experience being so unbelievable to me, that no one would ever believe me, that they would think I had lost my mind. I suggested that what was needed was absolute proof that this had happened, maybe B could give me something to take back with me. He agreed and asked what I would like. I looked around the room and found a large book. I asked if I could take this with me, and he agreed. I was so happy and thanked him. I opened the book and found symbols written in long, narrow columns. He asked jokingly if I thought I could read it, and I said that this was impossible, I had never seen anything like it. But I was not taking this for reading purposes, but this was my absolute proof of this experience and that I would always remember him as long as I lived. Then I asked where he was from, and he asked if I knew anything about the universe. I said no, but I would like to learn. He went over to the wall and pulled down a map, strange to me. Now I would believe this to be a sky map. It was a map of the heavens, with numerous sized stars and planets, some large, some only pinpoints. Between many of these, lines were drawn, some broken lines, some light solid lines, 0.102, some heavy black lines. They were not straight, but curved. Some went from one planet to another, in a series of lines. Others had no lines, and he said the lines were expeditions. He asked me where the Earth was on this map, and I admitted that I had no idea. He became slightly sarcastic and said that, if I did not know where the Earth was, it was impossible to show me where he was from. He snapped the map back into place. I said that I did not intend to anger him but had told him that I knew nothing of such things. But there were many people here who did have knowledge of these things, and I knew that they would love to talk with him and would understand him. Then I suggested the possibility of arranging a meeting between him and these people, that this would be a momentous meeting, a quiet meeting with scientists or top people of the world. While I was saying these things, I was wondering if I could do this, but felt that it could be worked out some way. He asked why, and I said that most people did not believe that he existed, he would have a chance to meet us and to study us openly. He smiled and said nothing. I was in the middle of trying to sell him this idea, when several men appeared with Barney, who was still in a daze. I spoke to him, and he did not answer. I asked when he would be fully awake, and the leader said as soon as we were back in the car. We started to walk out the door, when one of the men said something, not understood by me. They all stopped and were talking excitedly. The leader went back and talked to them. A disagreement had occurred, and the leader seemed to be in the minority. He came up to me and took the book. I protested, saying that this was my only proof. He said that he knew this, and this was the reason why he was taking it. He said that he could see no harm in my having the book, but that it had been decided that no one should know of this experience, and that even I would not remember this. I became very angry and said that somehow, somewhere, I would remember that there was nothing he could do to make me forget this. He laughed and agreed that I might possibly do just that to remember, but that he would do his best to prevent me from this, as this had been the final decision. He added that I might remember but no one would ever believe me, that Barney would have no recollection of any of this experience, in case Barney might ever recall, which he seriously doubted, he would think of things contrary to the way I knew them to be. This would lead to confusion, doubt, disagreement. So if I should remember, it would be feasible to forget. It could be very upsetting. 303, we left the ship and walked through the woods. This time it seemed like a very short time. I spent the time saying that I would always remember and asking that they return, please, please return. The leader said that it was not his decision to make, he did not know if he would come back. I said that I was very happy about meeting him, and Hanor Ed, and thanked him for being kind. Them leave. All the men accompanied us. We came to the car, and the leader suggested that we wait and see. We agreed. Barney seemed to wake up as we approached the car, and he showed no emotion, as if this were an everyday occurrence. We stood on the right-hand side of the car, Barney was leaning against the front fender, and I was by the door seat. As we were waiting, she one thought of Delcy. I opened the car door and Delcy was under the front, she was trembling badly, and I patted her for a moment. Came out, and I picked her up, and held her, again leaning against the car door. Suddenly the ship became a bright glowing object, and it appeared to roll like a ball turning over about 3 or 4 times and then sailing into the sky. In a moment it was gone, as though they had turned out the lights. I turned to Barney, and I was exuberant. I said that it was the most marvelous, most unbelievable experience of my whole life. I patted Dilsey and said, "There they go. For the wear. And we are none the worse." We got in the car and Barney started driving. He said nothing during this whole experience, so I turned to him and asked, "Do you believe in flying saucers now?" He replied, "Don't be ridiculous." Then we heard the beeping on the car again, and I thought, "Good luck, goodbye, and 1 a.m. going to forget about you. If you want me to forget, I will, and one will not talk."